This is Games as a Podcast.
Today, we are super jazzed to be joined by Mr. Chris Southall. We both, Ethan and I, both worked with Chris at Sega, where he did a number of things. He led an elite crew of technologists to save titles in distress, which I really want to get into a bit because I find it fascinating. He also served as CTO for Sega of Europe, and at the same time, he built and led a marquee studio for Sega called Hardlight. And he managed to get entrusted with the crown jewels being Crazy Taxi and Sonic himself. There, they developed the acclaimed Sonic Dash that's been downloaded hundreds of millions of times, and they made one of my favorite games from my time at Sega Networks, which was Crazy Taxi City Rush, which is a mobile-first game that I thought was really faithful to the original with and brought a new twist to things. So I really count myself as lucky to have been able to work with him over the years and his team. His technical bona fides are unquestioned, and he's a lovely chap, and I'm really looking forward to the conversation. Thanks for joining.
Hello, that's very, very kind. Thank you very much for having me.
And so, Chris Southall, this is going to be a little confusing through the show, so I'm going to say Chris S. for our guest and Chris O. for my co-host here. I look forward to talking to you about not only what it was like to wrangle IP challenges through Sonic Team, but also Hulk Hogan. But we'll get to that later.
Oh, yes, Hulk Hogan. Yeah, let's get to that later, hey.
Chris, would you like to give a short intro? I obviously filled in a little bit, but if there's any other color you want to provide the listeners, that'd be awesome.
Maybe I could. I mean, that was a lovely intro, and it's nice to see you and speak to you again. It was great seeing you at GDC as well. That was fun, definitely. Although I was pretty jet-lagged. But yeah, no, you kind of captured it. I did various things over the years at Sega. I started there mainly because I used to make racing games at a place called Codemasters. And working on rally games, I got the opportunity to go to Sega to do a new version of Sega Rally. So I joined Sega in 2005 and had a long stint there and did lots of exciting things, which I'm sure we can get into later a little bit. I've kind of been at a different company called Sumo for the last six and a bit years now. So yeah, it's a scarily long career in video games development. I'm not gonna mention when I started exactly, but it was a long time ago. So yeah, it's a good fun industry, and I've been really fortunate to work on lots of interesting good things. And I think, you know, by the way, speaking to one of my ex-colleagues at Hardlight, I think we're over a billion downloads if you take Sonic Forces and Sonic Dash together now. So wow. That is some number, hey.
That's a lot of Sonic. A remarkable accomplishment. Strategic Tech Group, or STG as we all knew it when we were at Sega. Can you talk a bit about the genesis of that and the evolution of the team? I'd love to hear if you're comfortable sharing, one of your most challenging projects was. I just love this idea of you and a crack squad of devs just kind of parachuting in and saving projects that are in peril. Just sounds so heroic and interesting to me.
I can talk a little bit about it. So yeah, essentially, you know, just to give context for reasons I'll try and explain in a second, you know, I had a small team of very, very talented engineers with a bit of art and later some design input as well. What our task was for a number of years was to go and help projects. I wouldn't say save projects. I think that's a little bit extreme, but you know, we would be shipped around the globe to go and work on various interesting projects and help them out where we could. So that was a really cool job, actually. Where it came from was, I mentioned earlier, you know, I moved to Sega from Codemasters to do a version of Sega Rally. Without going into too many details, you know, we started that studio with blank PCs and we're writing engines from scratch. We weren't using an Unreal or a Unity at the time. Wow. I don't think Unity was even a thing in 2005. It's more later than that. So we had to build the engine. We had pre-released PS3 kits. I think our Xboxes were probably released. Build the engine and the game and do all that in 2 years. Essentially, wow. Mr. Surumi told me latterly that you know, Sega Rally did make money back. It did recoup its investment, but initially it had some problems. So we ended up shutting that studio that we'd built. Myself and Guy Wilde was the leader of that studio, and he started the thing, really. I was just a passenger on that. But when we shut the studio down, we did have some amazing devs. So the decision was let's keep some of those devs to do troubleshooting. So we ended up working on, you know, some of the Total War games, the Football Manager games in the UK. Bayonetta was an interesting one. Maybe I'll use that as the example, Chris, in terms of the most challenging one. Yes, Vanquish. We went to work on Vanquish. Spent some time in Sonic Team, which maybe kind of leads into some of the later stuff we were doing with Sonic the Hedgehog when we set up Hardlight as well. And a few titles over in America as well, including Aliens, Colonial Marines, which was definitely challenging. But I'm not going to go any deeper into
the game that shall not be named.
Yeah. So that's the end of that subject. But, you know, on the subject of Bayonetta, we've been doing a lot of work with PS3 and SPU programming and technical things that I won't bore people with. But, you know, PlayStation 3 was a reasonably nerdy, techie machine to wring the most power out of. Some of the teams in Japan, including Platinum, you know, they were cool on Xbox. Everything was fine. PlayStation, not so much. So we were coming up to, and I can't recall if it was an E3 or another show, let's say E3. They needed a PS3 demo. The PS3 version was not running at all. They had an Xbox version. They had an external dev in Japan who was doing the PS3 version. So I think we had 3 weeks or maybe 2 weeks. It was a ridiculous timeline to just ingest the... we took the Xbox code and we got that running at 60 frames for E3 or whatever the show was. And that was an interesting process. It was challenging because working across time zones as well and ingesting their code as they kept madly developing the Xbox version in those last 3 weeks as well. But also fun. So, yeah, that was a good one.
You didn't go to Japan? You were doing that remotely?
For Bayonetta, we did not, no. When we went to work on Vanquish, we went over to Japan for a bit, but there was just not time. You know, it was literally start now, guys. The journey to Japan would have wasted a couple of days at least.
Wow.
So we would just drag their code from Subversion, which is what the team, I believe, was using at the time, which is a source control tool that a lot of the Japanese studios certainly around that time were using, and we went at it. I have to say, that's not me touching lines of code. It's all due respect to the team of engineers that we had at the time. They're very talented. They are very talented folks. So yeah, that was an interesting one.
What a weird time in history where a company like Platinum, like so very Japanese in terms of its design and of course where they're all based, would be using Xbox 360 as their base platform instead of PlayStation. That still is crazy to me. And I really wish you guys had been there to help with Sonic 06 as well. I know that was just out of your window, but boy, the PS3 version could have used a helping hand.
Yeah, that's another game that had some challenges. Hey. But yeah, you know, that was a good relationship. And, you know, I think they certainly had Havoc Physics in Vanquish, and I think Bayonetta as well. I might be wrong. So some of the guys worked over in Osaka for a good few weeks on Vanquish, you know, primarily optimizing PlayStation and making sure Havoc was playing nicely. Because Havoc's a piece of technology that was built in Dublin. So there were sort of links, stronger links, and, you know, we could help from a support point of view. But so much so that I know once Mikami-san, he didn't contact me, of course, but he contacted the important people when he was setting up his next thing. He contacted two of the guys, Ivan and Rosh, I believe. But by that point, Ivan was a very sort of key person at Microsoft, and Rosh was leading a team in EA Vancouver by then. It was, you know, a time with that tech group. It was nice to be able to go and work with lots of different super, super high caliber teams. It was a privilege, really.
How was it to work with Kamiya specifically? Kamiya-san for Bayonetta?
So the Bayonetta thing, I haven't finished the story, have I? Because actually that PlayStation version was never used in the final version. That third party or that external dev team ended up doing the version of Bayonetta that ended up on a disc or available for download. I forget whether it was downloadable at that point. So yeah, I didn't have much contact with Kamiya-san. It was mainly Mikami-san when we were doing Vanquish.
Okay.
He was a lovely guy and fun to go out with as well.
I can only imagine. I as a fanboy, I'm deeply envious that you had that opportunity. And Vanquish, I love that there was a button dedicated to just taking a drag on your cigarette. That was very cool. Very stylish game.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Bayonetta was an emergency demo project. What was the Vanquish engagement like? Was it similar in helping them with the PlayStation version of the game, or did you play a slightly different role?
Yeah, I think it was less of a, oh my God, what are we going to do? We need to get a demo done. Let's try multiple things at a time and, you know, ride multiple horses and the one that's the best wins for the purpose at the time. With Vanquish, I think it was just based on that work that had happened on Bayonetta. And like I sort of said, yeah, PlayStation optimization, they were probably a bit weaker than my team at that point in time, and sort of the Havoc knowledge that we had in the team as well. That conversation sort of happened leading on from Bayonetta. And of course, you know, Platinum as a team were not really an internal part of Sega. They were sort of an independent studio, but they saw the value in using some of our help on Vanquish to get, you know, Vanquish was another one where it was really demanding in terms of frame rate, and there was a lot going on in the game. Very, very sort of pixel perfect. Vanquish is another example of a game that was satisfying but challenging to play, right?
Yeah, that's rough. Can you talk a bit about the evolution of SDG into Hardlight, if that was actually how it happened, or at what point did Sega decide, okay, well, SDG is less of a focus for us and maybe it's time to harness these resources in a slightly different way?
Yeah, it was a natural evolution, really. And, you know, by the way, I just suddenly remembered, Ethan, now you work at NVIDIA, some of our work used to be doing things like supporting hardware features. And so, you know, a PC team, for example, the guys at Sports Interactive or Creative Assembly would be busy making a game, and there's some latest hardware come out and it'd be cool to support some of the new features, but the team doesn't have time. We would go in and sort of work on that sort of stuff as well.
Oh, cool.
Whilst the main team were getting on with things. And so that's a common model with new hardware releases, as I'm sure you well know. With STG, it came to the point where we were a console transition. So not 3DS. 3DS sort of came and went, but let's say it was Wii U and PlayStation Vita. And somebody at the company said, hey, can you tell us what these consoles are going to do? And in the history of console development, it was always very much how many polygons is something going to push? What's the fidelity of the graphics? What lighting effects can it do? You know, what's the horsepower on the GPU when they came into existence and the CPU? But actually, this console transition was a little bit different. And, you know, it was less about what you can push. It was more about what you can actually do with touchscreens coming in. PlayStation Vita had a back screen. Cameras, front and back facing cameras. Wii U obviously is a novel device in terms of the control input and things like that. So when I was asked that question, I said, well, we can tell you how many teraflops it will do or how many polygons it might render, but it's a meaningless answer, really. What we really need to do is think about prototyping some things and sort of look at the kind of use cases and demos that you might think about, you know, how you innovate on some of the newer titles that are coming. As I said before, we had some design inputs. A chap called Simon, who went on to move to Rare and did Sea of Thieves, and a talented artist called Rich Torn, who have come with me along the way here and there throughout my career, doing bits of art on various games we worked on. So we started building demos, and there was a really cool demo. The company said, actually, that's so cool. Can you make a full game of it? It was an action-adventure game. It was on PlayStation Vita. I'm kind of trotting through this relatively quickly. I don't want to bore everyone, but the PlayStation Vita then was maybe not the massively successful commercial entity that Sega was looking for at the time. And Sega had been having a lot of success on mobile in Japan by this point. I think at one point it was the number one publisher in value in Japan. So the business sort of moved its eyes to the West a little bit. There's a chap called Haruki Satomi, and you know this well, Mr. Olsen, I'm sure you do. It was like, okay, these guys, forget that Vita game. It looks great, but probably not going to be commercially super useful for the company. So why don't you try and do some mobile stuff? So we started doing some mobile stuff, starting with a game called Sonic Jump, which is very much really a sort of mini console game on a mobile device. We thought it was a mobile game. We thought we were making a mobile game, but over the time after that game, we kind of started to learn how different mobile games need to be versus something that's on console and PC. But yeah, that's where the studio started. It started with that tech team telling the company what kind of cool things you could do on the next generation hardware coming out, and we ended up doing mobile, and the rest is history for that studio.
Yeah, what a great history.
Yeah, and obviously Sonic Dash was a huge part of that. I remember Sonic Dash coming out initially as a premium game.
Yeah.
I remember also it was made free at Starbucks for a while too. You could get those Starbucks cards and download it for free, which was really cool. But then obviously it shot through the stratosphere when it went free. And I correct me if I'm wrong. I'm sure if there's anyone who knows, it's the two of you. But I believe Sonic Dash is still the most played Sonic game of all time in terms of just total number of users, right?
Oh, without a doubt.
Yes. Second only but to Sonic Forces, and number three is Sonic Dash 2, I believe, in terms of volume of downloads and probably hours spent. But yeah, it flipped from paid to free. And I know what a fan you are of free-to-play games and microtransactions, Ethan. Let's not get into that debate.
No.
On sort of the good, bad, and the ugly with that. But yeah. And that came about. Oh, it's an obvious question, isn't it? Okay, Sonic is our biggest IP. What can you do that's interesting on mobile? Mr. Woodruff, as I say, he departed after that point, and he went to work at Rare and did other cool things. And, you know, he's moved on since then after starting Everwild, I know. It was kind of like, well, Sonic Runs, Temple Run, it was kind of an obvious idea, and then it's down to the execution, isn't it? And I think we made that game in 4 or 5 months to from sort of sign off to initial release, and a team of people are still working on it to this day, and that's one decade on, I think. Wow. It's been running over 10 years now, so isn't that amazing? And yeah, it's still doing fairly big numbers. I don't have the specifics, obviously, because I'm no longer party to them, but yeah, it's still pretty healthy.
I think if I could go back in time, I would have pressed for Sonic Dash to have been released for free from the jump, and I think that it would have had even a bigger impact than it did or has had, personally.
Yeah, the other thing about that game is we'd started working on it, and then another company sort of released a game called Subway Surfers, and dang, they got there before us.
Yeah.
Obviously, if you take Sonic Dash, the size of Subway Surfers is an order of magnitude above that again. But those games just work on that form factor and that hardware. And it's sort of their forever games, really. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
But one thing I thought was really interesting about Sonic Dash was its ability to adapt to whatever premium Sonic game was coming out. Like, so when Sonic Lost World came out, it was able to highlight one of the bosses from that and have a sequence that was in that world. And that kind of connectivity, I, as a Sonic fan, always thought was really neat.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the trials and tribulations to leave things like that in the game, because from a gameplay perspective, they were useful for variety and so on. And it wasn't necessarily the ideal thing from the IP owner point of view to sort of keep polluting Sonic Dash with all these different sort of versions that are coming out. But I think, you know, it really helped keep the game fresh, and that continues to this day. But that goes into one of the parts of that work is making sure that you're spending time with the IP holders, whether it's Sonic or Crazy Taxi or anything else, making sure you have that connection, and you're treating those IPs and the execution with the care and the respect it deserves. And that's, ironically, you know, something that the company I work at the moment is very talented at doing as well, you know, working with other people's IPs and doing brilliant things with them. It's a special skill into itself, I think, doing that.
Do you think that there's a difference between doing it internally, like you did at Sega, versus doing it externally, like you're doing at Sumo?
From a team level, no, I don't think so, because from a development team level, you're looking for people who really are fans of that IP and respect that IP, and, you know, have the desire to do something maybe new, but something with a lot of knowledge and respect of what that IP is. And so that's the same from a development team point of view. I think it's just from a business point of view, yeah, it's quite different. I think it's maybe easier in some ways or harder in other ways if you're an external development partner to work on that stuff. I always remember when we were doing the first Sonic Racing, where my job was to go into Sumo and help those guys on that. I was still at Sega at the time. You know, that had a lot of different IPs in it. The merry dance of ascertaining whether the IP holder, because, you know, the system was and still really is in Sega, you know, the original creator for each game owns that IP, and those individuals sign off whether you can use a Crazy Taxi or Super Monkey Ball or whatever it may be in that game. And it's just a thing you need to realize. It's important you spend time on it.
Yeah, I sometimes felt really badly for some of the developers who had to work on IP with strong IP stakeholders. The biggest example was when we were working with BioWare, and they were doing Sonic Chronicles. And somehow they had gotten the wrong style guide from us. They got the style guide for Sonic X, the TV show, instead of Sonic, the game character. And so they got flagged and had to rework a lot of the art because it was just slightly the wrong shade of blue for Sonic. And they had used the Sonic X shade and not the official video game shade. And no one, of course, could tell the difference except Sonic Team. But nonetheless, we had to have them redo a significant amount of work to make that happen. How often do you run across things like that? Things that, again, are just so in the weeds that only the people who are flagging it would ever see it.
I think you come to expect it and predict it. If it doesn't happen, then that's a pleasant surprise. And it's not just IP holders of things like Sonic or... You know, if Izuka-san thinks that the color of blue should be slightly different, you know, that's, it is what it is. It happens. But, you know, when you're doing games with licenses and IP in there, you know, depending on, you know, going back to vehicles, doing lots of games with lots of different vehicle manufacturers in, or soccer games, as you would refer to them in the States, yeah. Football games. Individuals or certain businesses have very different attitudes to the rigor with which they will check things down to the point. And I think, you know, it was an interesting thing on the first Sonic Racing, and I digress slightly, but it's kind of the same thing. You know, there was animations in the cars for Sonic Racing that were never visible to the player because they were sort of hidden by the parts of the car. But you know, Sonic Team wanted us to get those animations and all of that stuff working perfectly, even though it wasn't visible. And I think it's just a sort of a level of detail, and you've got to respect and expect that, I think.
Yep.
But if you get the wrong style guide, that's not a good start, is it?
No, for sure. You know, that's not Sonic Team's fault, to be very clear. But yeah, and they're just as exacting with their own teams. But I think you'd appreciate, Chris, this story where I was working on a Super Monkey Ball game for Vita, and the Sonic Team had a bunch of notes. We flagged them as bugs, and it was so voluminous that we said, okay, can you please just mark them like A to C in terms of priority, just so we know exactly what we have to focus on first? And they said, sure, no problem.
Let me guess. All A.
Yep, that's exactly right. Every single one was listed A.
Yeah, there you go.
That is not surprising. Can you talk about some of the challenges of aligning dev teams around mobile and specifically the service-based business model? Did you find when you were forming Hard Light that folks were pretty up for it, or did you have to kind of do some strategic hiring or realignments to get to where you needed to go?
Yeah, totally. I can talk about that. I mean, as I've mentioned, sort of the inception of Hard Light as a mobile studio came from essentially a bunch of console developers and free to play on mobile. It was still early days at that point, but it had been happening for a while. But essentially, for free to play and thus a service model, because a successful free to play game is a service game by its fundamental nature, understanding, you know, systemic design, all of the aspects of what you need to do in order to run LiveOps, which is a lot wider than just having design, art and programming. There's a lot of other disciplines that are needed to run that successfully. But the first thing was definitely some people, just a bit like some people quite near us now, they're just not into service-based free-to-play models. There's definitely a snootiness from certain console developers, and that's fine. I respect that opinion, where mobile games aren't really proper games and they're not interested in working on them particularly. So there was definitely a transition for some of the people as we moved over to mobile. And in general, the current studio, one of the studios I'm responsible for, you know, hiring out of the gate, we knew we were going to be doing things which were service-based, even if they weren't mobile, a lot of mobile as well. People who are invested in that and interested in it and believe in that as a good model for games and understand the balance between metagame and systems design and, you know, how a core game should work within that. It's very, very different to a traditional console game or even a service-based console game. So, yeah, it comes down to one thing, which is always the same thing, which is the people. Do they understand it? Are they interested in it? Are they excited by it? You know, when they're coming to work day in, day out, are they kind of playing these kind of games in their spare time? Are they invested? Do they have energy to put into that? Or would they rather be working on a console game with some DLC? And so you have to look for, you know, a team of people who are happy working together on what you're trying to build. And it may seem not that different at first glance, but it's night and day different. Making a game that goes on a disc or is sort of patch day one and some DLC versus a game which needs to entertain lots of people who are never going to pay anything and do a good and respectful job of players who are investing money to play that game, and game that's going to be running for 5-10 years. It's a very different beast, basically.
Yeah, I agree. And your day one patch comment actually had me kind of think of a bit of a tangential discussion. Over the course of your career, can you comment or reflect on this concept of day one patch? So back in the box product days, you didn't have the luxury of a day one patch. So
day one patches, when we used to have to get everything right for a Gold Master, and that what went on that disc, it stayed like that. It was never going to change again. Having a bit more flexibility on, you know, coming towards the end of game development and crunch being a thing, especially back in the day in the industry. It's still here now, but we certainly personally, I avoid crunch within teams. And if you're working on a live service game, actually you can't even do crunch if you're a poor manager and you wanted to do that, because people need to keep going. So they can't crunch and then fall over once the game's on the disc. But being able to patch either day one or day seven or month one to do updates, it's great for the dev team. It doesn't mean that we can be lazy and, you know, not get everything right, because QA and submissions, and we want to have a game that is right at the point it goes on a disc or you do a package for it to be downloaded. Having that flexibility to be able to do a patch is super good for the dev team, and, you know, it's even better for players, because actually, whilst it can lead to some amusing anecdotes and some things on games which are quirks which become famous, it's kind of better if we can get the game experience exactly how we intended it, rather than having some accidental bugs or anything. And the opportunity to fix that stuff is, yeah, it's a sigh of relief versus the older way of just you were stuck, everything went on a disc.
Now, what I'm going to make one prediction. My son and I love going to retro game stores and buying old Game Boy Advance and Super Nintendo cartridges. And so I wonder from that perspective, it's a niche of a niche, but some Switch games, for instance, do not have a day one patch. They're almost always first party Nintendo games. I wonder if those are going to be earmarked as particularly more valuable to collectors down the line, because if it doesn't require a day one patch, then when you buy it 20 years from now and all the servers are down, you know you have something that was considered content complete right when it hit the store shelves. And that compared to some games where, like, I believe the last Call of Duty, it was basically just an unlock key that you had on the disc and everything else was downloaded. So again, 20 years from now, that disc is not going to be particularly useful. But Super Mario RPG on Switch will be a full game.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, isn't it? Yeah, it could well be. Yeah, that's that whole discussion of servers staying up.
20 years after that, it probably won't be worth anything because it will stop working. But yes.
Well, we'll see. I'm playing...
Just because physical media aren't forever.
I know. But to be fair, I'm playing 35-year-old Super Nintendo games, you know. So I hear you.
Yeah, emulators are a thing.
Have you experienced any kind of ones that just stop working after a certain period of time? I would expect... In that 40-year range, you'll start to see the physical media breaking down.
Yeah, I think inevitably that will happen. It hasn't happened yet for even Game Boy games, mm-hmm. Except for battery. So batteries have to be replaced. So if you have a classic Pokemon game, if you're going to buy that, you usually double-check and make sure that the battery's been replaced, because otherwise it'll be likely dead.
Interesting.
Disc rot is a different story, though. Like, the discs don't last as long as cartridges, and that's a problem, too. So you can still play, like, PlayStation 1 games, but 10 years from now, that might be an iffier proposition.
Yep. I'm a big music fan, and I remember the industry and the big push to CDs, marketing them as forever. You know, this is on digital, it's forever, and then comes to pass that CDs, in fact, degrade pretty markedly over time. So not surprising to hear it's the same on the game side as well.
When they first came out, you know, when CDs were just the advent of CDs, people would be scratching them with stuff and saying, hey, look, you know, they're bomb-proof, aren't they? And, you know, that did not come to pass, did it?
No.
Well, so, Chris, one thing I was always thinking about looking back on the games you created for mobile, I think one real edge that Hardlight had was making games truly feel intuitive on a touchscreen. action games, 3D action games. Sonic is a great example, but Crazy Taxi as well. Crazy Taxi was so much more complicated, so much more difficult to make work on a touchscreen. But ultimately, you guys nailed it. You had to have a little patience as a player to understand, to kind of reroute your muscle memory in terms of how to play that game on that device. But it never felt like something that was built first for the arcades or for a home console and then ported over. It felt very natively mobile, and once you got the hang of it, you could play it one-handed effortlessly, and it's shocking how hard that is and how well you did it.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it just takes a lot of time, focus, and attention. And there's an example, going back to your retro, you know, you can't go and get that game from a retro game store. It no longer exists in the world, right? Because it's no longer up on any servers. But yeah, you know, I think that is just time and attention and spending time. I would expect or hope a lot of teams would be doing this, but just spending a lot of time playing your own game and making sure that you're testing it and giving it to other people as well. And you're being as objective as possible in terms of someone picks something up and you think it's the best thing ever and you've got the controls nailed and actually you clearly haven't, you know, just being objective about it as well and spending the time necessary on it. And I think maybe that also comes from a team of talented developers who were coming from action sort of console games and that kind of background as well.
Yeah, I remember also that the metagame in that case, I think there was a certain point at launch where really effectively the most you could spend in the whole game was like $30. I recall that, you know, there was less of a focus on kind of that long-term spending potential. And again, it felt more like a arcade game, if anything. How did you evolve that when you were in mobile, like from just the kind of like $30 spend to something that could sustain 8 to 10 years?
I think that was a poor metagame implementation. Let's leave it at that, because $30 is not a deep enough spend. When we first launched that game, I think we got 5 to 7 million players on the first week, and it wasn't server authoritative, which means it's only online. It would play without the servers working, which is lucky because the servers all locked, and that was a learning experience and a half as well. For us, at least, some people drop into it kind of knowing this from day one. It's about modeling out what a player's journey is going to be and making sure that whether someone's spending or not, they have valid and satisfying things to do over the elder game. By elder game, yeah, it can be 5, 6, 7 years as well. It's an upfront mindset, and it's sort of some people I think kind of just get it, or you know, it takes a while for other people to get that sort of deep understanding of what that actually means from a systems design perspective or a metagame design perspective. But also the core game, you know, you need the core game to play nicely and support that metagame doing those things where things are changing or developing over months and years.
So, Chris, I worked for a long time on a game that was made in Japan, and then we made efforts to localize it in the US, and it was challenging to do so. It was called Kingdom Conquest 2. It was one of those games that it was a 4X game with action gameplay elements as well as the strategic map. And most people would bounce off of it hard because it used so many different systems and it was so complicated. But the people who stuck hard as well and would play for a long time and be deeply invested and work with their guilds. I know that there were plans afoot to build a more westernized Kingdom Conquest 3 and that was going to happen through Hardlight. Can you tell us a little bit about that and why maybe it didn't ultimately come to market and what you learned from the whole process?
Yeah, you know, that was a process where, again, Japan teams saw a reasonably talented developer in the West, and bringing Kingdom Conquest to the West, it makes sense to have a Western developer working on something because the culturalization, the cultural references, just sort of the natural kind of feel of something does come through from the locale from which the developer is at. So we did end up working on Kingdom Conquest 3 at Hardlight, but we had team members from the Kingdom Conquest team, not the original guy, because he'd gone to Microsoft by that point, I believe, or somewhere else. But the team from Japan probably spent far more time in the UK than they really wanted to be doing. And we got that game to a point of soft launch. From a technology point of view, it was an interesting thing as well. It's very different from a Sonic Dash or even a Sonic Forces, which is an online multiplayer game, rather than Sonic Dash, which is fundamentally single player, massively multiplayer, you know, 10,000 people on a single map all interacting. And the complexity in Yeah, even for a 4X game, Kingdom Conquest was complex, as you said, and we actually dropped the action part of the game because, you know, you had more systems in there than most Western 4X games had already, even without the dungeon. You had a system in the original game where you went through dungeons, you went through different floors of dungeons to acquire stuff, acquire currency, fundamentally. We took that out, but the deck building part was still significant and the sort of fad Western 4X part was significant. And yeah, it was a steep learning curve. I think we got there. We, you know, we had reasonable performance in soft launch, but fundamentally the team in Japan wanted to take it back. And I really actually don't know the answer to this. I don't quite know what happened. I do know that the back end technology was quite different from, you know, we were MongoDB, we were a NoSQL system, whereas the team in Japan was used to using an SQL system. Mm. Maybe it was that, maybe it was something else that caused them not to continue working on it. But yeah, you know, we got that to a point where we had, you know, reasonable KPIs, and like you say, it bounced some people off, but a lot of people were spending a lot of time in that soft launch, fairly dedicated players. But yeah, we moved on after that, and you notice that even in the West, 4X games have moved on a lot. You know, something like, I mean, Star Trek's 7 years old now. Star Trek Fleet Command is an example, and there's many more new examples. They kind of onboard people on something that doesn't feel like a 4X game. Actually, it's more narrative or story, and then you're playing, you know, then you're playing a 4X game, and you're suddenly kind of locked in with your guild or your clan and doing all the 4X things that those games traditionally have in terms of systems. But yeah, talk about systems, you know, different systems in games. 4X games are kind of up there with the level of complexity of any mobile game. But I think, you know, most mobile games that you sit down and play, you'd be surprised at kind of what's going on under the hood. There's a lot of complex stuff happening there.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it also that people don't understand is how important the guilds are with that, how critical the experience is to be working with other people and the conversational systems and being able to translate, because you're often dealing with global team members and stuff like that. It is pretty hefty. I do remember kind of a funny moment with Kingdom Conquest 2. We had a card for a character that was mistranslated, and the players thought it was hilarious because it was supposed to be Orc Ballista, and Japan put it down accidentally as Orc Barista. So we thought it would be fantastic if, and one of our artists, maybe it was Chris Bretz, I don't remember who, but actually mocked up a card that was that orc with the Starbucks type uniform on and holding a cup of coffee. And we suggested it to Japan, but they were very humorless about it. And they're like, no, let's fix the misspelling and move on.
Shame.
Yeah. But yeah, very interesting, because this all means that, Chris, you have experienced like the most extreme ends of the industry, from like cutting edge, high tech, like racing games that are you know, sold on the performance and, you know, how high tech it is, all the way down to the complex 4X games that don't even have any action mechanics, but are trying to do a million things under the hood to keep communities engaged. That's, I think that very few people have such a wide range of experiences under the belt.
Yeah, I've been lucky just to get to work on a generally, you know, interesting, quite different stuff, and generally pretty successful things as well. So I'm kind of blessed in that sense.
And I'd be remiss if I didn't ask about Hulk Hogan again, because that was such a crazy thing in Crazy Taxi. I remember we were looking at Puzzle and Dragon at Japan offices, and there was a desire to do what they were doing, because they had like Batman in Puzzle and Dragon, and they were doing all sorts of cross-promotional activities, and we were trying to figure out the right one for Crazy Taxi. If you can tell us kind of the story of how that unfolded, I think that would be fun to talk about.
Yeah, it's definitely a true thing that, you know, having IP crossover, doing collaborations is definitely a useful thing. I don't know if it's a banned phrase, but, you know, just look at Fortnite. So it says it all, really. These things work out well.
Yeah.
Having said that, I don't know what lunatic thought that they would go and speak to Hulk Hogan as the perfect sort of IP inclusion in Crazy Taxi. But it was fun, and I've got the poster, the signed poster, to prove it happened. And yeah, you know, it was something, seeing a large gentleman with a large, very yellow moustache in that game, for sure. But I actually can't give you any gory details, because I do not recall who the originator of that idea was or what. So yeah, the story has to end there, I think.
Yeah, I think Will Cox was the one on our side that went.
I think it was RPR.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, Will got to go. I think Jasmine was the one who kind of drove it, but
interesting.
I could be wrong.
Yeah, we did a thing on Crazy Taxi with the Yogs cast as well, which you may not be familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
That was a UK-based streaming and games show. So yeah, we included one of the Yogs cast people in. So we had two IP inclusions in Crazy Taxi. Had only we got the meta game working with the core game better, that game could still be running now, but you can't make a success of every single thing you do, I guess.
Well, and I remember Kano-san was very involved in that as well, the original creator of Crazy Taxi. And that's how it worked at Sega. If you created the original arcade game, you were going to be involved in any subsequent iteration. And I think that was to the strength of the company. I remember even when we were looking at Altered Beast on PlayStation 2, the original guy who did the arcade game, who also did Golden Axe and was focused on Beast Riders when that was being made, like had strong input. These guys like really cared. Kano-san, I remember coming to the U.S. office and sitting down with us and poring over the details of the pre-production documents and really trying to make sure that they got it right. Because the initial conversation was that Crazy Taxi was going to be a Vita game. We were talking about Crazy Taxi 4 for Vita. And then the plan shifted over to mobile, as you said, Chris. Did I get that chronology right?
I don't recall the chronology, actually. But yeah, working with Kano-san, I'd met Kano-san previously. I can't remember. It was one time I was over in Japan and I met him and he showed me his, because he came from AM2 and making a lot of arcade machines. And they had this basement in one of the buildings in Japan that was just, it was like Raiders of the Lost Ark. It was just this room full of these machines, like these loads of different ones. And so that was cool. So I'd met him already. He's a lovely guy. Even during that period working on Kingdom Conquest, you know, we would see him over there in the office and he was looking after some elements of that at one point in terms of the Japan side, I think. But yeah, he came over and worked on the original design with the design team and sat with us a number of times. And, you know, that was important. You know, that game was not a game that someone else was making in the sense that he had sign off and input into the design. He needed to be happy and we all needed to be comfortable for what we were doing with that. As you touched on, you know, it was quite a different approach to a control mechanic and the second to second stuff versus the original arcade games.
Yeah,
I think it speaks to the quality of the final product, right? To have someone who's a creator and heavily invested in what it is to be a Crazy Taxi title, to be so involved, I think just helped the process immensely and led to it being a very high quality product, not least of which because you guys developed an amazing product, but his input I think was instrumental in helping get there.
Well, and I believe it got Game of the Week featuring from Apple as well, which at the time was a very, very big deal. And I think Mike Evans probably was responsible for that, but really cool to see that Apple was excited about the game too when it was initially coming out.
Yeah, those were the days where if you got featuring, it gave you a ton of installs. It's not so much the case in this day and age. Featuring is not such a strong drag on many downloads. But yeah, as I said earlier, it was some millions just in the first few days, which made our servers fall over. So yeah.
One of those, it's a problem. We're kind of happy about it, but kind of freaking out at the same time.
Yes, and do you know what? That was an SQL. It was our problem. It was a schema design issue. It was a deadlock situation. That's part of the reason why we moved to a different backend technology going forward, which was a NoSQL MongoDB solution, at risk of talking too many acronyms and technical mumbo-jumbo.
Well, Chris, not to jump back and forth too much, but I got to say the very first Codemasters game I ever played in my life was a gold NES cartridge that was for Micro Machines. And
okay,
it. I absolutely loved it. I was working at a Software Etc. at the time, and we didn't get many copies of it in, but I bought one of those copies because one of the other copies that sold, the guy was a regular. He'd come back and he'd be like, this is so much fun. You got to play this. It's super great multiplayer. And it was. It was such a clever game. I was more of a Hot Wheels kid than a Micro Machines kid. So not about the brand, but it was just about playing on your living room couch and settings like kitchen tables and stuff like that. That was so much fun. Were you a Micro Machines kid or were you more of a Hot Wheels kid? Because obviously you love cars.
Yeah, very into cars, definitely. I was more of a Hot Wheels kid. Absolutely. But I definitely The reason I went to work at Codemasters was basically because of Micro Machines. I think it was the SNES. Do you call it the SNES in the States?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Super Nintendo. I played, as well as playing System Shock, I played a lot of Micro Machines at uni. And there was an advert in the Financial Times and I was thinking about what I'd do after uni. And it was from Codemasters. It was a rare thing that a games company were advertising in the Financial Times. But that speaks to how kind of smart and innovative Richard and David Darling were with the company. More of a Hot Wheels person, absolutely. But I think, as you say, Micro Machines, that series was of games were just really good games. And I really got the job at Codemasters because, A, I like cars. I spent a lot of time playing racing games. There was a Jeff Crammond game that predated F1 called Revs, which was like a Formula 3000. It had one track and then it got an add-on where it had three tracks. The main thing was Silverstone and I played the life out of that game. So going to Codemasters was a natural thing. But the reason they recruited me was, A, I'd done a reasonably techie degree. I'd done maths and computer science. But also it was important to, like I was saying earlier, in terms of anybody working on a game, you know, I had a passion for those games. And actually Micro Machines V3, I did work on that. And I worked on Micro Machines Military very briefly doing a texture compression thing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I did level design on Micro Machines V3 because we didn't have enough dev kits. So somebody had to use the dev kits at night whilst the engineers or the programmers used the dev kits during the day. I hadn't long started at the company. I was in the design department and I was like, I'll do that. You know, I'll work nights building levels. And my claim to fame in that game is there's a guy called Adam Norbury, who's one of the artists. Maybe I wasn't washing enough, I don't know. But one of the later levels that you have to unlock, it was a school level actually. In chalk on one of the desks, it says Stinky Chris. And that was a reference to my poor hygiene at the time.
That's
an interesting story.
That's great.
Well, you know, the other thing is with Codemasters, the ability that team had to stay ahead of the curve on technology. Like, again, they were there way back with the NES, but they were able to evolve from 2D to 3D and keep their business thriving in a way that very, very few studios that started at the same time did. And I remember talking to somebody within the industry that was talking about a company that was insisting on going 3D before there was a big market for it, at a time in which there was still Super Nintendo and a lot of the really experienced teams are like, no, we're focused on 2D. We're going to, you know, double down on that. And the company that was insisting on doing 3D instead was a little outfit called Epic Mega Games at the time.
Yeah.
And boy, they were right. But it seems like Codemasters was very similar, where it's like they saw early the importance of 3D and they really made a name for themselves with technology that, again, was ahead of the curve. That's been one of your kind of edges as an individual is working on cutting edge tech. But like, how did Codemasters continue to evolve with the times, and why is it that so many companies struggle with that, or studios?
Well, yeah, that's a wide-ranging question, I guess. But actually, by the way, I would kind of blame John Carmack on 3D. It was Doom.
Yes.
And that's my point, actually, because genius level engineer, some of the engineers at Codemasters were, you know, some of the most talented engineers and the art and design side as well, equally. And many people have gone on from that early stage of Codemasters to form companies or do very successful things. Subsequently, I could start listing, but the list is very, very long. And even I sat down with David Darling recently, his newer company, Quali. He's kind of knocked that out of the park after time and patience. And for Codemasters, it was less about embracing technology early. It was more about novel uses of technology and having, we had electrical engineers as well as computer engineers at the time, because one of the things back in the day that gave Codemasters some advantage, it was just a techie thing, but before licensing laws changed with platform holders, they had a warehouse. They were manufacturing their own Mega Drive cartridges. Sorry, the Mega Drive is called the Genesis in the States.
Yes.
I've probably said Mega Drive more than once.
No, that's fine.
Genesis cartridges. Yeah, so we didn't have to, or Codemasters at the time, made more profit on every game that they sold because they didn't have the license fee for the cartridge manufacture. And
wow.
You know, there's a number of things. The Game Genie is what made Codemasters, or gave Codemasters some funding to invest forward.
Oh, I forgot about that. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. We're going back into real ancient history of time here.
That's fascinating.
Yep.
But yeah, you know, there was a thing that was, I think it was for the SNES or the NES, probably the NES initially, and it essentially allowed you to kind of cheat games, and it was a thing that you plugged your cartridge into, and Nintendo weren't very happy about that. There was a lawsuit, Codemasters won. Codemasters got some money. But after that, I think the advent of 3D was just coming as I joined. You know, I worked on one of the first games I worked on as a programmer. I was working on 3DFX sort of partway through. That came out partway through, which was from someone called Voodoo Graphics, but that might have been acquired by, I don't know, AMD or NVIDIA or Matrox, some of these old names. Yeah, the 3D was just coming at that point, and I think Codemasters just did a good job of hiring very talented engineers who could take advantage of that stuff.
I remember when Sackboy's Adventure came out, it's like, I love the original Little Big Planet games, but the jumping mechanic always felt too floaty. And I know that that was probably tied into them having all the builder mechanics and stuff, but like, when you play Sackboy, it's subtle, but it just feels so much better. Same thing with Sonic, where 3D Sonic didn't quite feel right until Sonic Dash. The stuff that you've been responsible for, like, there's just that precision where it's like you get to a point where it just feels right, and that must take a long time.
Yeah, I think it's just slight obsessiveness and maybe, I said it earlier, sort of subjectivity and objectivity, just spending time on it. And I guess a certain eye for, or a certain feel for certain things. I have to say, Sackboy was built by my current company, and it's a great game. I've been at Sumo for, what, as I said, six years now, but Sackboy was built by our Sheffield studio. And yeah, like a lot of the sort of end-to-end original games that they've developed for other publishers, they did a nailed on job of all the mechanics and the story and the overall game, I think.
Yeah.
It won a good number of awards, if I recall correctly. And yeah, it was quite a big sort of initial launch title.
Absolutely. So Chris, you've worked on so many different types of games, but I wonder what your favorite game of all time is personally.
Right, well, that's a hard question, isn't it? Games have developed over the years. I'm going to take a sort of split answer and sort of name at least two. I think one of the original games that really fired my imagination was Elite. You know, that was going back a long time when I was a young kid. That was a space exploration game, and they put so much sort of emotion and sort of narrative into that game when it was sort of had to fit into however many kilobytes the BBC Micro had at that point in time. BBC Micro was one of the original things that company that's now called Arm did back in the day. And so it was a space exploration game. You had to fly around, you had to trade, you could sell narcotics or less illegal goods. And you occasionally encountered aliens in a later update of the game. But I spent a long time playing that game. You got different rankings and eventually you hit Elite, that's the name of the game. But I never got to Elite. I got to mostly Deadly, I think was my ranking. But that would be hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours playing that game. So that was a favorite from back in the day.
I think Deadly's a cooler rank than Elite anyways.
Yeah, indeed. I think so too. But then if you take hours played, it has to be Clash Royale, because I've been playing that game for 10 years, nine years, let's get it right. It's 9 years old just recently. And as with all good service games and mobile games, I probably play that game for 20 minutes, half an hour every single day as a minimum. Sort of have a fondness for that game. And, you know, I'm not playing it because I'm kind of sucked in or, you know, it's a grind. It's genuinely just a fun way to play for a little bit. And as you touched on earlier, there's a clan there. I don't particularly know the people in my clan, but some activities that we do together. And you talked about controls. I think that's one of the purest mobile game controls there is. You know, it's so low touch. Mm-hmm. You just, you know, you don't have to enter it. You know, it's not high cognitive load. You don't have to touch the screen all the time, but it's very nuanced in the mechanics that are happening in the game. It's essentially, you know, a lane-based tower defense game. It's a very interesting spin on that. It's kind of genius. So yeah, those are the, I could name more, but those are the two I'll name for the sakes of brevity.
That's great. Yeah, thanks for sharing.
Thank you.
Yeah, Chris, it's been great to have you on. Always good to catch up with you, and we really appreciate the time you've taken to talk to us and share some of your experiences. It's a pleasure as always. So thanks.
Yeah, you're more than welcome. It's a trip down memory lane, really. So it's kind of nice. I like it. So yes, maybe another time we can touch on some other subjects that are a bit closer to the modern day as well.
Yeah, for sure.
Most definitely. Cool, everyone. Thanks for listening. Take it easy.